Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Katie Britton. New York Times bestselling author Cassandra Clare is the it author when it comes to creating magical worlds. Having just completed her fifth book in the Mortal Instruments series entitled City of Lost Souls, she's simultaneously working on two other spin-off series with The Infernal Devices and the forthcoming The Dark Artifices. Clare will be at Oblong Books this Sunday with two other authors, Sarah Reese Brennan and Holly Black, who we will hear from next, to speak about her novels. So to get us ready, we're going to have a crash course in the Mortal Instruments and hear from Clare on why she wanted to bring readers into a magical world filled with warlocks, demons, vampires, fairies, and werewolves that's parallel to the human world.
Well, when I was a kid growing up, I always liked to imagine that there was a secret world that ran parallel to ours that contained all of the magical creatures, you know, fairies, vampires, ghosts, wizards, people with magical powers, and that we could access that world if only we knew the right door to go through or the right combination of words. I used to walk around New York when I was a kid, was where my grandparents lived, imagining, you know, that this door or that gate would take me to the magical world. And so when I grew up, I thought about writing a series of books in which that was actually true, in which there was a veil between our world and this magical world, and if you tore it down, you could see magic.
Tore it down. That's a really great description, because we are in a parallel world where we have the human beings, or mundanes, as they're called in the novels, and they have no clue really what is going on around them, that there are demons coming in, and then we have the shadow hunters who are there to kill the demons.
Yes. I like the idea that in this parallel world, there would need to be some kind of law enforcement. That, you know, it couldn't be completely chaotic. It would have to be a world that lived by its own rules. And I wanted to write about the people who made and enforced those rules.
So this brings us to Clary. And Clary is our main character. And she has been brought up as a mundane, a human being with no idea that there is this magical world right at her fingertips and on her doorstep.
Right. And I wanted to do that in part because Clary is our heroine. I wanted to create a sort of hero with a thousand faces plot in which Clary would grow into her heroic self and start her off at the very beginning with no knowledge of magic and no knowledge of that world so that we could learn it as she learns it.
I like what a spitfire she is. I mean, she has such a strong personality, and the other characters realize that as we go through the series. They say, well, you do what you want. You may ask us what we think, but no matter what, we know you are a bull in a china shop.
It's a very interesting way to write a heroine for me, because it's really often considered an unfeminine quality. This sort of, she's very risk-taking. She's very, you know, act first, think later, very go with her gut. She's not a consensus builder, which is something that people often look for in female characters. She makes up her mind and she does it. But that is definitely one of the qualities that is almost always see in heroes. You know, Harry Potter has it. Percy Jackson has it. Luke Skywalker has it. They all have this sort of, you know, I go with my gut because I'm a hero thing. And I wanted to give that to Clary, let her, you know, have that as a girl. And I think also she's very physically small. She's, you know, only about 5'3". She's a very petite girl. I wanted to kind of package all this up in a very, you know, physically unassuming girl. I thought that would be a kind of a fun reversal of expectation.
I like that you broke that mold. And it does take us a little bit to get used to it and think, what are you doing, you know, to
right.
It's natural and it's okay to be that way.
Right. There's no one right way to be a girl is one of the, you know, kind of messages I hope, you know, that people get from the books. There are other female characters. Isabel's very different. Maya's very different. But, you know, there's no one right and okay way to be a girl. That Clary is headstrong, you know, that's okay.
On the flip side, you did mention Isabel, and she has been born and raised as a shadow hunter, as well as her brother, Alec, and their adopted brother, Jace.
Mm-hmm.
So you have those three personalities, and each one is very distinct and unique. And Isabel, she is a girly girl, but man, she can fight like nobody else.
Isabel's a great fighter. Isabel's a lovely character to write. She's a lot of fun because she's grown up as a shadow hunter. She has that sort of intrinsic, little bit sense of superiority that she is a shadow hunter. She is a fighter, but she is also very conscious of, you know, of her own beauty. She, you know, she loves clothes. She loves shopping. I love the fact that her whole room is covered in, like, glitter and powder puffs and pink, and yet Isabel is deadly. You would never want to get in a fight with her.
I know, that whip, how she always has that whip as an accessory, you know, either wrapped around her arm or as a belt around her waist. But yet, as soon as that comes off, I mean, she could decapitate somebody with it.
Absolutely. And she does.
Yes. There are a lot of other underlying plots. I mean, we're talking about these wonderful characters that you have. But in this novel, in The City of Lost Souls, we have a fairly new character, and that's Sebastian, who is our biggest bad guy's son. And the question is asked, can you change as a person once you remove that parental influence?
I think there's a lot of questions in the book that are asked about, you know, and sort of the issue of nature versus nurture, you know, the issue of what makes you a good person. And to me, Jace and Sebastian represent sort of flip sides of the same coin. That's what's interesting about them. You know, they're not blood related, but they were both raised by the same man. And Sebastian is what Jace would have turned out to be if Valentine had had a few more years to work on him. You know, I think that Sebastian is, you know, we'll never know if he could have been changeable, if he'd been taken away from Valentine earlier, if he'd been given good instructions to follow from the time that he was a child, but he was raised to be a killer. And, you know, he says, I was taught he says that Jace was taught to paint and play the piano, and he was taught to play the instruments of war and paint in blood. And he can't get away from that. You know, I mean, the sort of the sad, you know, fact of Sebastian is that he can't break away from that early teaching.
And I find it interesting that their father is named Valentine, but yet it seems as if he's really, I don't want to say incapable of love, because we get many glimpses, but that's what Jace really wanted, was to know that his father loved him back. And I think Sebastian, too.
Yes, they both wanted their father's love and approval. And actually, Jace is really the one that had it. The interesting thing about Sebastian is that Valentine raised him to be a killer and then saw what he had created and was horrified by it. You know, he raised this son to be a murderer and be a genocidal killer, and then realized he had raised a genocidal killer and was kind of repulsed by his own creation. Whereas Jace, he raised but loved him enough to send him away when he was about 10 to the Lightwoods, who you know, gave him actual love and actual good teachings, and he turned out to be a good person. So Valentine is an interesting character in that regard, because, you know, he believes in his principles, and yet at the same time he has this sort of gut feeling. You know, he knows that with Sebastian he did something terrible.
And we see the other side of it also with Clary, because she is also Valentine's daughter who has his blood in her, and yet she was raised by her mother.
Right, so Sebastian's great, you know, quest in life is to try to find somebody who is like him, because he feels very unique in the world and very lonely. And so he keeps trying to make Jace more like him, and he keeps trying to convince Clary that she could be or is like him because she has Valentine's blood.
Now, did I read someplace correctly that this was originally supposed to be a trilogy?
It was originally supposed to be a trilogy with a spin-off series of graphic novels. And so I had planned out the graphic novels that would come after City of Glass, and then the graphic novel deal fell through. So I decided to write them as novels instead, because I was still invested in the story.
And your readers are obviously invested in the story and the characters as well.
Yes, happily they have come along with me for the journey.
You're going to be at Oblong Books, and in the second part of our interviews, we will be speaking with one of the authors who will be coming with you, Holly Black. For you, what is going on tour like when you get to meet all of the fans of the books and have that interaction with them?
Oh, it's the greatest. And I'm excited to go to Oblong Books in Rhinebeck. Rhinebeck is right near where I went to college, which is Vassar, so I'm well acquainted with Rhinebeck. And it's really great for me to be able to actually make public appearances and meet the readers because they're so enthusiastic, they're so sweet in person. They'll tell me stories about the books and how, you know, they've affected their lives. Often they'll show up, sometimes they'll have a whole family show up dressed like shadow hunters. It just really makes you feel like the world is very real for other people.
And how about when you are also there with the other authors?
Well, I'll be there with Holly Black and Sarah Reese Brennan. They're two of my best friends. So I love their work and I'm really excited to be able to kind of share our fan bases. You know, people who love Holly's books might not know mine. People who like my books might not know Sarah's. But, you know, this gives us a chance to kind of share our, you know, worlds and say, even though the worlds we've created are very different, you know, if you love magic, you know, and you love a good story, you know, you'll like any of these books.
I always find it interesting when one author points something out about their friend's books and they're like, oh, I never thought of it that way. And just the conversation that takes place between the authors.
It is interesting. And also, you know, we do work together closely often on our books before they're published. And sometimes thematically things pop up in the books that we didn't even notice are similar, but our readers will point out at events. You know, Holly and I was working on her Curse Workers books, which is what she will be signing, and I was working on City of Lost Souls, and we realized that we had both written stories about brothers, the relationships of brothers.
Cassandra, thank you so much for joining us today, and we look forward to seeing you on Sunday.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Again, the newest Cassandra Clare novel is City of Lost Souls. It is published by McElderry Books. And now we turn to another author who will be at Oblong this Sunday, Holly Black. She's the award-winning writer of the Spiderwick Chronicles and will be speaking about her Curse Worker series. Like Cassandra Clare noted, there are similarities to her and Black's work, but Holly Black takes it a step further by creating a new version of the mob.
Exactly. I wanted to tell a fantasy story, but I wanted to tell a story that was going to have a lot of cons and a lot of capers. And so I knew that the fantasy was going to have some kind of parallel feeling, some kind to a, you know, a world where cons would seem appropriate. And so I was looking for models for the way the magic was organized. And I thought of organized crime. And when I thought of organized crime, I thought of the heyday of organized crime, Prohibition. And that's how I got to basically the Curse Workers world where magic is illegal and controlled by the mob.
And not everybody's magical.
Not everyone's magical. A very small percentage of the population are what they call hyperbathygamic, and they have one of seven different abilities, where you can control. Most people can control luck. Most people who have, you know, who are hyperbathygamic or curse workers, what they call them, but they're not supposed to do this. They're not. Whatever their power is, they're not supposed to use it. Using it is illegal.
So that people, they're always wearing gloves, since when they touch somebody, that is when they can work their magic on them.
Yeah, it is a world in which bare hands equal danger. I thought that would be really fun, and it's fun to play with then what that means about the world and what it means to hold hands or shake hands and what it means to see the bare hands of another person. Comes very, like, forbidden. Like, oh, my God, I saw her bare hand. So wrong.
And we get that in this novel where there is a photograph of one of the other students in our main character Castle's private school with her bare hands.
Yeah. Very scandalous.
It is. And it's great because we have this mob world that is controlling them. But on the other side, there are the feds and the licensed minority division. In which they are recruiting these magical people.
Yes, for the government to, you know, use in semi-sketch ways. And Castle Sharp, our main character, is, you know, he's from a long line of con artists. He has ties, you know, his family has sort of ties to the big mob families, but he's sort of caught in the middle trying to decide who he wants to be and what kind of person he is. And I was really interested in telling that kind of story. I had read many years ago a true crime novel called Son of the Grifter about this kid whose mom was a grifter and who had raised him to really believe that, you know, that lying and cheating and stealing were expected of him, and if he wasn't good at them and wasn't doing them, then he was an idiot. He was a mark. And so, you know, his kind of journey to figure out, like, what did he actually believe, what was good and what was bad, really inspired me to try and create the character of Castle and, you know, have him sort of struggle with the idea of, you know, do I want to join the feds? That's a huge betrayal of all, my whole family, and I'm not sure I want that, but does that mean I'm a good person? You know, can I be part of this crime world and still, you know, have some kind of moral center?
Right, he's constantly telling himself, I promise I'll be good after this. I just need to just lie one more time, or I need to help Lila with something else.
This was the first time I actually wrote a first-person series, and the joy of the unreliable narrator was something I had never played with before, but it's really fun to be in someone else's head, you know, to write in someone else's head and have them constantly tell themselves things that even the reader doesn't believe.
As you say, I love that struggle within him, and it's that struggle of who do you trust? Do you trust your blood, your family, or mm-hmm. do you trust what the feds are telling you? Because they, like anybody else who he is in contact with, whether it's the mob in the big family,
mm-hmm.
want to use him for his particular yeah. talent, which is very scarce.
Yes. He has one of the seven types of curse working that is the most rare and, you know, most difficult to come by. And so, yeah, they're all really interested in him. And his family, who are pretty much, you know, clearly not good people, love him and are the most likely to take care of him, but also the most likely to make him do things that he finds the most unethical.
And there is Baron, and who is one of his older mm-hmm. brothers. And the reader doesn't trust him, especially
no.
because this is the third book in the series.
Mm-hmm.
And in the past two, Baron has not really been a good brother to Castle. He's used him.
No. Yeah, they do have a troubled relationship. Baron has used him. Baron's ability is he can do memory work, and so he can change Castle's memory so that he makes Castle do things and then forgets that he has done them, makes him believe things that aren't true. The thing is, all of the magic in this world has what's called blowback, and so whatever magic is conducted, some of it comes back at the worker themselves. And so in Baron's case, the more he does this to Castle or to anyone, the more he actually loses his own memories, which I think also makes him somewhat morally bankrupt. He loses what makes him human the more he does these things.
He has the notes on his refrigerator, the post-it notes saying, this is your name, this is when you
yeah.
were born, this is your family.
And it's sort of tragic, but the things that he has done to get himself into that place are so terrible that it's also sort of not tragic. It's sort of a comeuppance. And, of course, you know, Castle has this great love of his life, you know, this mobster's daughter, Lila. And he is really, really puts him in a position where there's only so far he can go in terms of the feds without getting her in some kind of trouble that he would never get her into. And her father obviously has, you know, being a head of the family, has his clutches in Castle, too.
Lila's father, Zakharov, it is the mm-hmm. Zakharov family, and there is a legislation that is trying to be passed by the governor of New Jersey, Governor Patton, which is a perfect name because he's militant about trying to drive this legislation forward, and that is to do what we've seen here in the U.S. with the Japanese internment camps of rounding up all of these curse workers and keeping them out of the regular population.
He's very militant, and he is in part very militant because of an experience, you know, that he had and that he's kind of still of a mess from. But, you know, he represents a real danger, and if the bill passes, then it represents a real danger nationwide because other propositions could pass. And so, yeah, I mean, one of the questions of illegality is, if something is illegal, does it become morally wrong? And, you know, the thing about, you know, curse working is this is magic. It's an ability that, if it wasn't illegal, might well be celebrated. It doesn't have to be used in the bad ways it has become commonly used. And so the more it becomes illegal, the more it becomes black market, the more it can't be controlled. And so, you know, all of the stuff about the proposition really is about, what does it mean when something becomes illegal? What does it mean when the government interferes to such a degree, demonizing, you know, some particular group of people.
And at the same time that Castle is trying to figure out his place and what side is good and bad. He's also trying to protect his friends like Sam and Danica.
Yeah, he is. Mostly, you know, when the series started, Castle was trying to stay out of all of this. This was, you know, something that was his family's problem. He didn't even know he had this ability. He really thought of this as somebody else's problem. And, you know, he has friends at school. And the more and more embroiled in the various conflicts between the feds, between the government and the mob families he becomes, the more embroiled they become as well, which is really, really hard because to them, I think a lot of this seems pretty fantastical and kind of amazing. And, you know, all of the cons he pulls seem kind of fun and daring, like school pranks, until all of a sudden it really takes on an element of reality. And I think really mostly in the last book in Black Art for Sam, it suddenly all becomes really real in a way he's for the first time deeply uncomfortable with.
And I like the way that you get into Castle's mind in the sense of how he can tell if somebody is lying, the tells that are there, and also how when he's dealing with Agent Yulikova, how she is just so good at delivering her lines and what needs to be said in a manner that makes him feel comfortable, even though he's pretty sure she's lying about it.
Oh, thank you. But one of the things that was the most fun in writing this series was all of the research in terms of, you know, both cons and also kind of the ways people, like the science of persuasion and the science of how you tell someone's lying. All of this, you know, stuff has been so studied and so sort of broken down systematically. And it was just so fascinating to take the time to go through and read about all of these different things. And actually, in particular, the cons, learning about different cons were so fun.
Mm.
You know, now I feel like I understand sort of the sort of steps of them. They're like this complicated dance, and there's a lot of variations of the same basic con. Just really interesting to get to learn. I'll tell you my favorite con.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Watch con, right? Two-man con. First guy goes into a bar. He's wearing a watch. Shiny, gold-ish watch. And brags about the watch to the bartender and must be a jerk so that the bartender does not like him, doesn't tip, but specifically assigns it a dollar value, leaves. So second man comes in and is like, I found this watch. I don't know who it belongs to. Do you know who it belongs to? And when the bartender, you know, whatever the bartender says, the second man offers to sell it to him for $20. Well, he knows that it's, you know, suited a Cartier watch worth, you know, thousands of dollars and, you know, forks over the 20 or the 50 or 100 or whatever you think you can get out of him. And of course it is a, you know, $2 watch. And there's so many variations on that. It could be anything, but it's this really great movement of, you know, first entice someone, then believe they can get it for nothing.
And we see that done in the book to a certain extent of the feds telling Castle, saying, if you do this for us, we will help your mother. We'll take her off of the mm-hmm. list and she'll be free.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, he thinks about it. Well, that's a pretty good deal. And then the brother says, are you really going to trust them, even though he's working for them, too?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, trying to figure out who you can trust, how you can trust someone. Yeah, because trusting his brother is also risky.
Yes.
So I think that. And trying to keep that balance was the real fun of writing the book, you know, trying to build sort of the puzzle box of a con, which is so mm-hmm. different than writing other kinds of books. It was really fun.
It absolutely comes through beautifully of this,
Yay.
The cons and the deception and who do you trust. Holly, thank you so much for joining us today, and we'll see you on Sunday.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a lot of fun.
Again, Holly Black is the author of the Curse Worker series, with the newest and final book called Black Heart. It is published by McElderry Books. And you can meet Holly Black, Cassandra Clare, and Sarah Reese Brennan this Sunday at Oblong Books in Rhinebeck, New York at 4 p.m. Reservations are required, and you can do so by going to oblongbooks.com. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.